will also serve as energy czar.
This is a huge job, right? The Department of the Interior is responsible for our public lands, about conservation, about how we use those public lands wisely for today and for tomorrow. And so he'll be in a position to expand oil and gas leasing in offshore water, on land, at a time when just last year's COP, as you mentioned earlier, the international community recognized we needed to transition away from fossil fuels. The United States is already the largest oil and gas producer in the world, increasing rapidly. And now we have someone who has promised to further accelerate oil and gas exploration in the United States. Perhaps most notably, we'll be lifting the pause on LNG exports that the Biden administration put in place just 6 months ago. And with someone like him responsible for energy across the entire administration, it creates real serious concerns about how we make sure that the United States stays focused on the clean energy transition. The one thing I would say, though,
we have 10 seconds,
is that the clean energy transition in the United States is unstoppable. It's going to hit some speed bumps now, but it will move forward.
Manish Bapna, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council and Natural Resources Defense Council Action. That does it for our show. Our deepest condolences to Karen Ranucci on the passing of her father, and a happy 80th birthday to Danny DeVito. I'm Amy Goodman here in Baku, Azerbaijan.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon State Democrats could secure a supermajority in Salem. Washington legislators will consider free school meals for all students. And the Siletz tribe regains a piece of its ancestral territory on the Oregon coast. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 18th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon State Democrats in the legislature could enjoy a supermajority this term thanks to the late results in House District 22. The district covers Woodburn and parts of Marion County. Last term, they elected Republican Tracy Kramer, but a slow trickle of votes has turned the race in favor of Democratic challenger Leslie Munoz. Last week, that margin was just one vote between the two of them. Now, Munoz has 104 more votes than Kramer. That could be enough to hold off an automatic recount, too, which is required if the margins between the candidates are a fifth of a percent apart. Democrats have held majority in both houses of the Oregon legislature for over a decade, but this margin would be different. A 3/5 majority in the state legislature for Democrats would mean that the party doesn't need any Republican support to pass their agenda. A supermajority is required for passing new taxes in Oregon. The Joint Committee on Transportation has been prepping a large transportation funding package that could include new taxes for the past 6 months. Now, there are still some ballots in House District 22 that would need to be cured if their signature doesn't match their ballot. Those voters become public on Certification Day, December 2nd, and they're likely to be contacted by both parties, encouraging them to cure their ballot with the county. Washington state legislators will likely consider a bill to provide free school lunch to all students in the state. Their biggest barrier? An impending budget crunch. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Washington lawmakers will consider providing free school meals to all students in the state. Thanks to legislation passed in previous sessions, 70% of students in the state have access to free breakfast and lunch at school. That's nearly 800,000 kids. State Representative and Senate-elect Marcus Riccielli has led previous efforts to expand free meals in schools. The Spokane Democrat says he'll be introducing a bill in the 2025 session to reach all students.
This is a driver of health. It's a driver of a reduction in absenteeism. And we can't expect students to do well and thrive academically if they're hungry.
Nine states currently offer free school meals to all students regardless of income level. However, the biggest barrier in Washington could be the state's budget deficit, which is $10 billion over the next 4 years. The Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction has also requested $17.6 million to continue feeding the kids it currently serves. But Riccielli hopes that doesn't stop the state from going forward with universal free meals.
We're headed into what could be a little bit of a budget crunch. And again, I think these are some of the best dollars that we could spend, but it does cost money. We're working with OSPI to really understand what would close the gap with the remaining students.
Riccielli says there are a lot of advantages to offering free school meals for the state's families.
It's also a middle-class tax cut. We also know that parents are trying to get out the door, trying to get to their jobs, and this is a burden that's taken off the table, and inflation has hit a number of families. So I really think this is something that resonates.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Today is the last day for the public to submit comments on the environmental impacts of the plan to replace the I-5 bridge that crosses the Columbia River. It's projected to cost $7.5 billion, and the input from the public will help inform the environmental impact statement to be released late next year. Critics and supporters agree that the bridge between Portland and Vancouver needs to be replaced, but they disagree on what it should look like. The current plan for the bridge would expand the lanes on the highway with auxiliary lanes and safety shoulders. Critics say that's a problem. A study commissioned by the Just Crossing Alliance says the traffic numbers used to design the bridge are all wrong. They say widening the bridge would not improve traffic congestion on I-5 and could actually make it worse. They also say that the bike, pedestrian, and public transit plans for the bridge are inadequate. Hayden Island residents who live in the middle of the crossing are pushing back, too. They worry how building the bridge will impact them, and some 76 homes on the island are likely to be demolished for the project. The public comment period on the environmental impact of the bridge is open until midnight tonight. Comments can be submitted at interstatebridge.org/draft-SEIS. The Siletz tribe has reacquired 27 acres of their ancestral territory on the Oregon coast. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coastal piece of the Siletz tribe's ancestral territory has been restored. The announcement coincides with the 47th anniversary of the tribe regaining federal recognition. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
27 acres of Cape Foulweather on the Oregon coast have been reacquired by the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians. The tribe purchased the land from the Mackenzie River Trust last month with a $2 million grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
It really is an amazing opportunity for us to become stewards again.
Angela Sondana is director of the tribe's Natural Resources Department. She hopes to reintroduce cultural burning to the coastal prairie section to rejuvenate its ecosystem.
Cape Foulweather is an incredibly diverse and sensitive ecological area. It's been a cultural gathering site for millennia.
Sondana says it's been a good year for the Siletz. Last December, President Biden signed a bill sponsored by Representative Val Hoyle, restoring gathering, fishing, and hunting rights to the tribe on their ancestral lands.
And it will provide direct opportunity for tribal members to gather and resume subsistence harvest in the rocky coastline there.
The Siletz Reservation was established in 1855 by Congress and President Franklin Pierce. It was further diminished through land cessions. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Conservationists and tribes say they intend to sue the federal government if it does not take steps to protect a rare snail, which is threatened by a lithium mine. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
The Kings River perg is tiny, about the size of the tip of a ballpoint pen, and it's found only in an area of Nevada called Thacker Pass, where there are plans to mine lithium, the key ingredient for electric car batteries. Paul Ruprecht is with the Western Watersheds Project. He says mining will shrink the small springs that the snail relies on.
The species is really vulnerable because fluctuations in water availability could really impact its ability to continue to exist in these areas.
The conservation group had previously petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the snail as endangered. The agency was supposed to make a decision this year, but never did. So the nonprofit and several tribes informed the government they intend to sue. The People of Red Mountain is a group of knowledge keepers from the Fort McDermitt Paiute, Shoshone, and Bannock tribes. They say they have a cultural responsibility to protect native species in the area. Federal officials now have until mid-January to respond. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Alaska's vote counting process will finally come to an end this Wednesday, but Nick Begich III is already declaring victory in his bid to unseat U.S. Representative Mary Peltola. Between Friday and Saturday, an additional 24,000 ballots were counted, although they closed the gap between Peltola and her Republican challenger to about 8,300 votes. Begich still maintains a lead of more than 2 percentage points against Peltola. A candidate must have more than 50% of the vote to avoid ranked choice voting in Alaska. That's when the second choice votes of other candidates in the race are added to the totals. Although 318,000 ballots have been cast, Begich so far has failed to meet that threshold, so the race will likely be determined by ranked choice. Peltola, a Democrat, had a strong, well-financed campaign, but failed to overcome the coattail effect of Donald Trump's big win in Alaska, which boosted Begich's campaign. Meanwhile, a ballot measure that seeks to overturn Alaska's open primary and ranked choice voting system is passing by the slimmest of margins by only 0.2 percentage point. In August 2022, ranked choice voting helped Peltola win a special election to fill Congressman Don Young's seat after his death, making her the first Alaska Native to serve in Congress. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
House Democrats want the Gates Ethics Report released. Trump's Energy Secretary pick could jeopardize the future of U.S. climate action, and Laura Trump could fill Marco Rubio's place in the Senate. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think it was Justice Brandeis who once said that sunlight is the best disinfectant in a democracy. Transparency is always the best course of action.
Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says the House Ethics Committee should release its report on Attorney General pick Matt Gaetz. The committee lost jurisdiction and shelved its sexual misconduct and illicit drug use investigation when the Florida congressman abruptly resigned his seat. Speaker Mike Johnson calls the report a rough draft, but several Republican senators say they want to see it before the narrowly divided chamber considers the nomination. Government watchdogs are warning against President-elect Donald Trump expanding presidential power during his second term. Supporters say voters gave him that mandate, but USC public policy professor Bill Resch says if Trump follows Project 2025, he will undermine democracy by putting loyalists in important independent positions.
Project 2025 puts into place principles such as loyalty, first and foremost, to the president as a criterion for placement into these agencies.
Trump is standing by his pick for defense secretary, veteran and Fox News commentator Pete Hegseth, who has been accused of sexual assault. Trump has chosen Liberty Energy CEO and campaign donor Chris Wright to be his energy secretary. Wright's nomination could fast-track Trump's plans to boost fossil fuel energy and end national climate policies. But speaking in Brazil, President Joe Biden says climate change magnified storms hitting that nation and the Southeast U.S., adding clean energy is coming.
Some may seek to deny or delay the clean energy revolution that's underway in America, but nobody can reverse it. Not when so many people, regardless of party or politics, are enjoying its benefits.
A Pennsylvania environmental group is one of many backing a soon-to-be-finalized global plastics treaty. Almost all plastics are made with fossil fuels, and the southwestern part of the state is a fracking epicenter. Sarah Martick with the Center for Coal Field Justice is urging the Biden-Harris administration to ratify the treaty before leaving office.
Right now, waste trade is such a huge issue, and the United States, as both a producer and a consumer of a lot of plastic goods, exports a lot of our plastic waste to other countries, and those other countries have more ambition in this treaty than we do.
South Dakota voted to maintain an abortion ban, though other factors may impact reproductive care in the state. Kim Florin with the Justice Through Empowerment Network says they're watching federal policies on things like mailing abortion medication.
I'm feeling the panic from people who are in areas that maybe haven't experienced what we've experienced as far as barriers go. But the reality is that we as a community can figure out how to take care of one another.
10 states voted on abortion ballot measures, with South Dakota being one of three keeping its ban in place. RNC co-chair and the president-elect's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, is being eyed as the favorite to fill Florida Senator Marco Rubio's seat if he becomes Secretary of State. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. On this episode, hosts speak with author Gretchen Sisson on her book Relinquished, The Power of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 48. Today in history, in 2003, a Massachusetts court rules that the state's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional and gives the state 180 days to change the law. This ruling made Massachusetts the first state in the U.S. to grant marriage rights to same-sex couples. The quote of the day is from Canadian novelist and critic Margaret Atwood, born this day in 1939. She said, quote, "The fabric of democracy is always fragile everywhere because it depends on the will of citizens to protect it, and when they become scared, when it becomes dangerous for them to defend it, it can go very quickly." End quote. For National Adoption Month, one Oregon nonprofit organization says it's time to focus on the experiences of Black and Indigenous adoptees. Adoptees are more likely to suffer from a variety of mental health struggles, and BIPOC Adoptee Voices was created to spread awareness about these struggles and make space for BIPOC adoptees to heal together. Isabel Charlet reports.
November is National Adoption Month, and one Oregon nonprofit is making space for Black and Indigenous adoptees to share their stories. Although most adoptees are well-adjusted, research indicates people who've been adopted are more likely to have mental health struggles and are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide. Liana Soifer, who heads the group BIPOC Adoptee Voices, says if the dominant story around adoption is too focused on parents and advocacy groups, the struggles and triumphs of adoptees can be overlooked.
Adoption is based on a transaction. You're adopted, you're done, you're good, your life is fine. And for many of us now adult into adulthood, we're saying, no, it's not fine.
Soifer was adopted from South Korea by a white family and says having limited information about where you come from can lead to feelings of shame and isolation. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call or text the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. In Oregon, most adoptees are adopted by close family members. On average, 125 children are waiting to be adopted from foster care. That number has declined significantly in the last 6 years after the Oregon Department of Human Services changed its policies to minimize child separation. Soifer emphasizes that every adoption story is unique and says the public needs to learn about the struggles adoptees experience along with their successes.
Changing the way that we frame things, not good or bad, but just like here's the reality, is the most important thing we can do, is just like educating how those adoptees, how the birth families are impacted.
Soifer adds getting to know other BIPOC adoptees has been important for building her own sense of belonging. BIPOC Adoptee Voices hosts regular free mixers and storytelling events. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Child welfare advocates in New Mexico are working to build a groundswell for baby bonds legislation before lawmakers convene in January. Similar state-funded savings accounts have been adopted in California and other states. Roz Brown reports.
New Mexico child welfare groups are behind an initiative they plan to introduce in the next legislative session to create a so-called baby bonds program. The Partnership for Community Action and other advocacy groups introduced a pilot program earlier this fall. Executive Director Nichelle Gilbert says 15 children received trust accounts of $6,000 available to the child when they turn 18.
These funds that are invested grow over time and are available to invest in things like education, starting a business, owning a home, or to pursue other opportunities that foster upward mobility.
Proposals for baby bond programs have passed in California, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C., and have been introduced at the federal level and in 8 additional states. The New Mexico State Treasurer, who supports baby bonds, recently held a symposium to discuss and develop a bill to be introduced in the 2025 legislative session that would create a statewide program. New Mexico has a high rate of poverty and one of the widest income gaps. Gilbert says if lawmakers approved the concept, eligible children would receive a publicly funded trust account at birth, providing them with a startup fund to pursue a prosperous and directed adult life. She believes the program could help dismantle inequities and reduce barriers to wealth.
It's encouraging local investment. It's promoting asset building. It's facilitating education and careers, and all the while breaking cycles of poverty.
Roughly 28% of New Mexico's children younger than 5 and a quarter of those younger than 18 live in poverty, while the national poverty rate is about 11%. Child advocates unsuccessfully pitched legislation to require a financial literacy course in high school, but lawmakers made it an elective instead. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Environmental groups are preparing to take legal action against the Line 5 crude oil pipeline project. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources just approved permits. That's despite overwhelming community pushback. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
A legal challenge is expected since the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has granted key permit approvals to a Canadian energy company to reroute its controversial Line 5 pipeline in northern Wisconsin. The DNR's approval allows Enbridge Energy to begin preparations for the rerouting project. Attorney Stephanie Sosi with Earth Justice represents the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribe, whose lands have been directly affected by Line 5 for years. She says Enbridge still needs federal approval to move forward with construction.
So this is not a foregone conclusion that Enbridge is going to have this pipeline operating. There's a lot of processes, there's a lot of approvals, and this is just one of them. And we're ready to stand with the band and figure out ways to make sure that whatever approvals there are, that they comply with the law.
She explains the current line is illegally trespassing on tribal lands, and Enbridge's solution is to add 41 miles to reroute it, which would still have dire consequences in the event of an oil spill. A pending lawsuit by the tribe to have the line completely removed from its lands awaits a federal court decision that could halt the project entirely. Labor groups favor the jobs the Line 5 project could bring to the state, and industry and ag groups that rely on the fossil fuels the pipeline transports. Meanwhile, environmental groups say the risk of oil spills and damage to waterways and wildlife is paramount. But attorney Evan Feinauer with Clean Wisconsin says that debate misses the bigger picture by ignoring the current climate threats and their generational consequences.
I just hope that people can hold that long-term view in their heads and think about people beyond themselves, including people who are children today or not even born yet, and think about the world that they're going to have to inherit. And that includes all of our choices, including our mistakes.
He says Clean Wisconsin will take legal action to challenge the DNR-issued permits for Line 5 and ask that construction be paused until it's resolved. Enbridge says the rerouting project would create more than 700 jobs, many for tribal members, and provide millions in tax revenue to the state.
The City of Seattle's Green New Deal initiative has involved community assemblies where people are deeply engaged with finding solutions for protections against climate change, especially in frontline communities. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Community members in Seattle had a unique opportunity to weigh in on the policies guiding the city's climate goals. In 2019, the City of Seattle passed the Green New Deal Resolution and Green New Deal Executive Order with the goal of eliminating climate pollution by 2020. To help guide that process, the initiative's oversight board supported community assemblies. Peter Hesegawa is with MLK Labor and co-chair of the Green New Deal Oversight Board. He says the idea behind the community assemblies was to do deep listening with many different community members.
To have the opportunity to present information and get feedback and have people think about solutions together over a longer period of time was appealing to us because we thought we could get higher quality feedback.
MLK Labor and Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle hosted the assemblies. The goal was to ensure that people on the front lines had their voices heard and were at the table as the city crafts policies going forward. Faduma Fido is with the People's Economy Lab, which helps support the community assemblies. She says they're piloting this type of engagement at the city level because people are tired of going to listening sessions. She says the assemblies provide a more empowering setting, with people compensated for their time and eating meals together. Fido says they want to bring democratic practices like these back.
There's an appetite and willingness now to empower the citizens, empower communities to practice democracy beyond the ballot box, because often that tends to be very polarizing.
Hesegawa says they heard from a variety of people over the three sessions. In the first, they heard about people's experiences being affected by extreme weather, such as the 2021 heat dome and a freeze last winter that caused many people's pipes to burst. In the second session, they heard about winds on the ground to protect people and workers from the effects of climate change. Hesegawa says in the third, they brainstormed about what the city and local labor movement can do about climate change.
In certain ways, that ended up being the easiest session because there was a very high level of consensus that what workers in Seattle want is to be protected from extreme weather. They want to be protected from heat and smoke and bursting pipes, and they want to be protected whether they work in a building or outside or in a home.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Citizen scientists and volunteers in North Carolina and other states play a critical role in tracking local rainfall across the country. Their simple measurements contribute to weather warnings and climate records, filling gaps in high-tech forecasting. Shantia Hudson has more on that effort.
In North Carolina and across the U.S., a network of volunteers operates 26,000 rain gauge stations, and together they're quietly transforming weather forecasting. Their backyard observations fill critical gaps left by high-tech radars, feeding the National Weather Service real-time data used for life-saving alerts and long-term climate records. Jennifer Oldham, who first reported the story for Yes Magazine, says she found as climate disasters intensify, the citizen-powered data has never been more essential, as once-in-a-lifetime weather events appear more frequently.
Many of them post results every day of the precipitation they collect from these old-fashioned rain gauges mounted in their backyard online. And anyone can go to this online network and take a look at these results.
The North Carolina State Climate Office used the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network to track rainfall from recent storms. Volunteers recorded 24 inches in Spruce Pine and nearly 22 inches near Black Mountain in Hendersonville during Hurricane Helene. But these efforts face potential challenges as the conservative playbook Project 2025 proposes dismantling NOAA, the agency that oversees the National Weather Service, citing climate propaganda concerns. Oldham warns losing these services would weaken forecasting abilities and public safety during extreme weather.
These weather services, their mission is to warn people and help them not be surprised by these big storms. And if they don't exist, I'm not sure how people would get their information.
She adds the value of the community network is not only enhancing weather forecasting, but also fostering community involvement. Local volunteers gain a deeper understanding of weather science and climate change impacts in their areas, making this a powerful educational tool as well. For North Carolina News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson. This story was produced with original reporting from Jennifer Oldham for Yes Media.
An abandoned golf course now stores stormwater and helps protect homes from flooding. During downpours, ponds collect water that would otherwise run off into streets and homes. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Over the last decade, an abandoned golf course in the Clear Lake area of Houston has been transformed into an urban oasis called Exploration Green. Community members go there to walk and bike along 6 miles of pathways past ponds and wetlands teeming with birds and other wildlife. But at its core, the area was designed for a more functional purpose, protecting homes from flooding. David Sharp is with the Exploration Green Conservancy, a nonprofit that helps support the project.
We have a lot of homes in the neighborhood that with any kind of heavy rain would tend to flood and get water inside, which of course is devastating for the homeowners.
And the risk is growing as the climate changes. So residents approached the local water authority for help. The agency purchased the old golf course and created a series of stormwater detention ponds. During heavy rain, the ponds collect water that would otherwise run off into streets and homes.
We have the ability to retain 500 million gallons of water.
It's then slowly released into the local bayou. Sharp's group, which is largely volunteer-led, help restore natural habitat around the ponds, so nearby residents can escape to nature and return to a dry home. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Judith Ruiz, Branch Shantia Hudson, Suzanne Potter, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm.